of going wrong and destroying that which they were supposed to protect, which only added complexity to a job with too much complexity already. The world of espionage was one in which everything that could go wrong invariably did. And so, over the years, every way of simplifying operations had been adopted by all the players. The result was that since what worked for one man worked for all, when you saw someone following the same procedures as your own intelligence officers and agents, you knew you had a player in your sights. And so the stakeout on the beach was renewed. Of course, it had never been withdrawn, in case Suvorov/Konyev should appear unexpectedly while the transfer case was gone off to the lab. With an ever-changing set of cars and trucks, plus coverage in a building with a line of sight to the bench. The Chinese subject was being watched, but no one saw him set a telltale for the dead drop. But that could be as simple as calling a number for Suvorov/Konyev's beeper. But probably no, since they'd assume that every phone line out of the Chinese embassy was bugged, and the number would be captured and perhaps traced to its owner. Spies had to be careful, because those who chased after them were both resourceful and unrelenting. That fact made them the most conservative of people. But difficult to spot, though they might be, once spotted they were usually doomed. And that, the FSS men all hoped, would be the case with Suvorov/Konyev. In this case, it took until after nightfall. The subject left his apartment building and drove around for 40 minutes, following a path identical to one driven 2 days before, probably checking to see if he had a shadow, and also to check for some telltale alert the FSS people hadn't spotted yet. But this time, instead of driving back to his flat, he came by the park, parked his car 2 blocks from the bench, and walked there by an indirect route, pausing on the way twice to light a cigarette, which gave him ample opportunity to turn and check his back. Everything was right out of the playbook. He saw nothing, though 3 men and a woman were following him on foot. The woman was pushing a baby carriage, which gave her the excuse to stop every so often to adjust the infant's blanket. The men just walked, not looking at the subject, or, so it seemed, anything else. "There," one of the FSS people said. Suvorov/Konyev didn't sit on the bench this time. Instead, he rested his left foot on it, tied his shoelace, and adjusted his pants cuff. The pickup of the holder was accomplished so skillfully that no one actually saw it, but it seemed rather a far-fetched coincidence that he would pick that particular spot to tie his shoes. And besides, one of the FSS men would soon be there to see if he'd replaced one holder with another. With that done, the subject walked back to his car, taking a different circuitous route and lighting 2 more American Marlboros on the way. The amusing part, Lieutenant Provorov thought, was how obvious it was once you knew whom to look at. What had once been anonymous was now plain as an advertising billboard.
"So now what do we do?" the militia lieutenant asked his FSS counterpart. "Not a thing," the FSS supervisor replied. "We wait until he places another message under the bench, and then we get it, decode it, and find out what exactly he's up to. Then we make a further decision." "What about my murder case?" Provorov demanded. "What about it?" "This is an espionage case now, Comrade Lieutenant, and that takes precedence." Which was true, Oleg Grigorievich had to admit to himself. The murder of a pimp, a whore, and a driver was a small thing compared to state treason.
His naval career might never end, Admiral Joshua Painter, USN, retired, thought to himself. And that wasn't so bad a thing, was it? A farm boy from Vermont, he'd graduated the Naval Academy almost 40 years earlier, made it through Pensacola, then gotten his life's ambition, flying jets off aircraft carriers. He'd done it for the next 20 years, plus a stint as a test pilot. Commanded a carrier air wing, then a carrier, then a group. And finally topped out as Sacklant, Sinklant, Sinklant Fleet. Three very weighty hats that he'd worn comfortably enough for just over 3 years before removing the uniform forever. Retirement had meant a civilian job paying about 4 times what the government had, mainly consulting with admirals he'd watched on the way up and telling them how he would have done it. In fact, it was something he would have done for free in any officer's club on any Navy base in America, maybe for the cost of dinner and a few beers and a chance to smell the salt air. But now he was in the Pentagon, back on the government payroll, this time as a civilian supergrade and special assistant to the Secretary of Defense. Tony Brentano, Josh Painter thought, was smart enough, a downright brilliant engineer and manager of engineers. He was prone to look for mathematical solutions to problems rather than human ones, and he tended to drive people a little hard. All in all, Brentano might have made a decent naval officer, Painter thought, especially a nuke. His Pentagon office was smaller than the one he'd occupied as Op 5, Assistant Chief of Naval Operations for Air, 10 years earlier, a job since de-established. He had his own secretary and a smart young commander to look after him. He was an entry port to the SecDef's office for a lot of people, one of whom, oddly enough, was the vice president. "Hold for the vice president," a White House operator told him on his private line.
"You bet,"
Painter replied.
"Josh, Robbie."
"Good morning, sir," Painter replied. This annoyed Jackson, who'd served under Painter more than once, but Josh Painter wasn't a man able to call an elected official by his Christian name.
"What can I do for you?"
"Got a question. The President and I were going over something this morning, and I didn't have the answer to his question. Can an Aegis intercept and kill a ballistic inbound?"
"I don't know, but I don't think so.
We looked at that during the Gulf War and..." "Oh, okay, yeah, I remember now. We decided they could probably stop one of those Scuds because of its relatively slow speed, but that's the top end of their ability. It's a software problem. Software on the SAM itself."
Which was the same story for the Patriot missiles as well, both men then remembered.
"Why did that one come up?"
"The President worried that if the Chinese toss one at Taiwan and we have a ship alongside, well, he'd prefer that the ship could look after herself, you know."
"I can look into that," Painter promised. "Want me to bring it up with Tony today?"
"That's affirmative," Tomcat confirmed.
"Roger that, sir. I'll get back to you later today."
"Thanks, Josh," Jackson replied, hanging up. Painter checked his watch. It was about time for him to head in anyway. The walk took him out into the busy E-ring corridor, then right again into the SecDef's office, past the security people and the various private secretaries and aides. He was right on time, and the door to the inner office was open.
"Morning, Josh," Brentano greeted.
"Good morning, Mr. Secretary."
"Okay, what's new and interesting in the world today?"
"Well, sir, we have an inquiry from the White House that just came in."
"And what might that be?" Thunder asked. Painter explained.
"Good question. Why is the answer so hard to figure out?"
"It's something we've looked at on and off, but really Aegis was set up to deal with cruise missile threats, and they top out at about Mach 3 or so.
But the Aegis radar is practically ideal for that sort of threat, isn't it?"
The Secretary of Defense was fully briefed in on how the radar computer system worked.
"It's a hell of a radar system, sir, yes," Painter agreed.
"And making it capable for this mission is just a question of software?"
"Essentially, yes. Certainly it involves software in the missile seeker head. Maybe also for the spy and SPG radars as well."
That's not exactly my field, sir.
Software isn't all that difficult to write, and it isn't that expensive either. Hell, I had a world-class guy at TRW who's an expert on this stuff. Used to work in SDIO downstairs. Alan Gregory, retired from the Army as a half-colonel, Ph.D. from Stony Brook, I think. Why not have him come in to check it out?
It amazed Painter that Brentano, who'd run one major corporation and had almost been headhunted away to head Lockheed Martin before President Ryan had intercepted him, had so little appreciation for procedure.
"Mr. Secretary, to do that, we have to..."
"My ass," Thunder interrupted. "I have discretionary authority over small amounts of money, don't I?"
"Yes, Mr. Secretary," Painter confirmed.
"And I've sold all my stock in TRW, remember?"
"Yes, sir."
"So I am not in violation of any of those fucking ethics laws, am I?"
"No, sir," Painter had to agree.
"Good. So call TRW in Sunnyvale. Get Alan Gregory. I think he's a junior vice president now. And tell him we need him to fly here right away and look into this, to see how easy it would be to upgrade Aegis to providing a limited ballistic missile defense capability."
"Sir, it won't make some of the other contractors happy."
"Including," Painter did not add, "TRW. "I'm not here to make them happy, Admiral. Somebody told me I was here to defend the country efficiently."
"Yes, sir."
It was hard not to like the guy, even if he did have the bureaucratic sensibilities of a pissed-off rhinoceros. "So let's find out if Aegis has the technical capabilities to do this particular job."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"What time do I have to drive up to the hill?" the SecDef asked next.
"About 30 minutes, sir."
Brentano grumbled. Half his working time seemed to be spent explaining things to Congress, talking to people who'd already made up their minds and who only asked questions to look good on C-SPAN. For Tony Brentano, an engineer's engineer, it seemed like a hellishly unproductive way to spend his time. But they called it public service, didn't they? In a slightly different context, it was called slavery, but Ryan was even more trapped than he was, leaving Thunder with little room to complain. And besides, he'd volunteered, too. They were eager enough, these Spetsnaz junior officers, and Clark remembered that what makes elite troops is often the simple act of telling them that they are elite, then waiting for them to live up to their own self-image. There was a little more to it, of course. The Spetsnaz were special in terms of their mission. Essentially, they'd been copies of the British Special Air Service. As so often happened in military life, what one country invented, other countries tended to copy. And so the Soviet Army had selected troops for unusually good fitness tests and a high degree of political reliability. Clark never learned exactly how one tested for that characteristic, and then assigned them a different training regimen, turning them into commandos. The initial concept had failed for a reason predictable to anyone but the political leadership of the Soviet Union. The great majority of Soviet soldiers were drafted, served 2 years, then went back home. The average member of the British SAS wasn't even considered for membership until he'd served 4 years and had corporal stripes, for the simple reason that it takes more than 2 years to learn to be a competent soldier in ordinary duties, much less the sort that required thinking under fire. Yet another problem for the Soviets, who didn't encourage independent thought for any of those in uniform, much less conscripted non-officers. To compensate for this, some clever weapons had been thought up. The spring-loaded knife was one with which Chavez had played earlier in the day. At the push of a button, it shot off the blade of a serious combat knife with a fair degree of accuracy over a range of 5 or 6 meters. But the Soviet engineer who'd come up with this idea must have been a movie watcher, because only in the movies do men fall silently and instantly dead from a knife in the chest. Most people find this experience painful, and most people respond to pain by making noise. As an instructor at the farm, Clark had always warned, "Never cut a man's throat with a knife. They flop around and make noise when you do that." By contrast, after all the thought and good engineering that had gone into the spring knife, their pistol silencers were garbage. Cans loaded with steel wool that self-destructed after less than 10 shots. When manufacturing a decent suppressor required only about 15 minutes of work from a semi-skilled machinist. John sighed to himself. There was no understanding these people. But the individual troopers were just fine. He'd watched them run with Ding's team too, and not one of the Russians fell out of the formation. Part of that had been pride, of course, but most of it had been ability. The shoot-house experience had been less impressive. They weren't as carefully trained as the boys from Hereford, and not nearly so well equipped. Their supposedly suppressed weapons were sufficiently noisy to make John and Ding both jump. But for all that, the eagerness of these kids was impressive. Every one of the Russians was a senior lieutenant in rank, and each was airborne qualified. They all were pretty good with light weapons, and the Russian snipers were as good as Homer Johnston and Dieter Weber, much to the surprise of the latter. The Russian sniper rifles looked a little clunky, but they shot pretty well, at least out to 800 meters. "Mr. C, they have a ways to go, but they got spirit. 2 weeks, and they'll be right on line," Chavez pronounced, looking skeptically at the vodka. They were in a Russian officers' club, and there was plenty of the stuff about. "Only two?" John asked. "In 2 weeks they'll have all their skills down pat, and they'll master the new weapons." Rainbow was transferring 5 complete team sets of weapons to the Russian Spetsnaz team. MP-10 submachine guns, Beretta 45 pistols, and, most important, the radio gear that allowed the team to communicate even when under fire. The Russians were keeping their own Dragunov long rifles, which was partly pride, but the things could shoot, and that was sufficient to the mission. "The rest is just experience, John, and we can't really give 'em that. All we can really do is set up a good training system for 'em, and the rest they'll do for themselves." "Well, nobody ever said Ivan couldn't fight." Clark downed a shot. The working day was over, and everybody else was doing it. "Shame their country's in such a mess," Chavez observed. "It's their mess to clean up, Domingo. They'll do it if we keep out of their way." "Probably," John didn't add. The hard part for him was thinking of them as something other than the enemy. He'd been here in the bad old days, operating briefly on several occasions in Moscow as an illegal field officer, which in retrospect seemed like parading around Fifth Avenue in New York stark naked holding up a sign saying he hated Jews, blacks, and NYPD cops. At the time, it had just seemed like part of the job, John remembered. But now he was older, a grandfather, and evidently a lot more chicken than he'd been back in the 70s and 80s. Jesus, the chances he'd taken back then. More recently, he'd been in KGB. To him, it would always be KGB, headquarters at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square, as a guest of the chairman. "Sure, Wilbur." And soon he'd hop in the alien spacecraft that landed every month in his backyard and accept their invitation for a luncheon flight to Mars. It felt about that crazy, John thought.
"Ivan Sergeyevich!" a voice called.
It was Lieutenant General Yuri Kirillin, the newly selected chief of Russian Special Forces, a man defining his own job as he went along, which was not the usual thing in this part of the world.
"Yuri Andreevich," Clark responded. He'd kept his given name and patronymic from his CIA cover as a convenience that, he was sure, the Russians knew all about anyway. So no harm was done. He lifted a vodka bottle. It was apple vodka, flavored by some apple skins at the bottom of the bottle, and not bad to the taste. In any case, vodka was the fuel for any sort of business meeting in Russia, and since he was in Rome, it was time to act Italian. Kirillin gunned down his first shot as though he'd been waiting all week for it. He refilled and toasted John's companion.
Domingo Stepanovich,
which was close enough. Chavez reciprocated the gesture.
Your men are excellent, comrades. We will learn much from them.
Comrades, John thought. Son of a bitch. Your boys are eager, Yuri, and hard workers.
How long? Kirillin asked.
His eyes didn't show the vodka one little bit. Perhaps they were immune, Ding thought. He had to go easy on the stuff, lest John have to guide him home.
2 weeks, Clark answered.
That's what Domingo tells me.
That fast? Kirillin asked, not displeased by the estimate.
They're good troops, General, Ding said. Their basic skills are there. They're in superb physical condition, and they're smart. All they need is familiarization with their new weapons, and some more directed training that we'll set up for them. And after that, they'll be training the rest of your forces, right?
Correct, Major. We will be establishing regional special operations and counter-terror forces throughout the country. The men you trained this week will be training others in a few months. The problem with the Chechens came as a surprise to us, and we need to pay serious attention to terrorism as a security threat.
Clark didn't envy Kirillin the mission. Russia was a big country containing too many leftover nationalities from the Soviet Union, and, for that matter, from the time of the Tsars, many of whom had never particularly liked the idea of being part of Russia. America had had the problem once, but never to the extent that the Russians did. And here it wouldn't be getting better any time soon. Economic prosperity was the only sure cure. Prosperous people don't squabble. It's too rough on the china and the silverware. But prosperity was a way off in the future yet.
Well, sir, Chavez went on, in a year you'll have a serious and credible force, assuming you have the funding support you're going to need.
Kirillin grunted. That is the question here, and probably in your country as well, yes?
Yeah, Clark had himself a laugh. It helps if Congress loves you.
You have many nationalities on your team, the Russian general observed.
Yeah, well, we're mainly a NATO service, but we're used to working together. Our best shooter now is Italian.
Really? I saw him, but...
Chavez cut him off. General, in a previous life, Ettore was James Butler Hickok. Excuse me, Wild Bill Hickok to you. That son of a bitch can sign his name with a handgun.
Clark refilled the vodka glasses.
Yuri, he's won money off all of us at the pistol range, even me.
Is that a fact? Kirillin mused, with the same look in his eyes that Clark had had a few weeks earlier.
John punched him on the arm.
"I know what you're thinking. Bring money when you have your match with him, Comrade General," John advised. "You'll need it to pay off his winnings."
"This I must see," the Russian announced.
"Hey, Eddie," Chavez waved his number two over.
"Yes, sir?"
"Tell the General here how good Ettore is with a pistol."
"That fucking Italian," Sergeant Major Price swore. "He's even taken 20 pounds off Dave Woods."
"Dave's the rangemaster at Hereford, and he's pretty good, too," Ding explained. "Ettore really ought to be in the Olympics or something. Maybe Camp Perry, John?"
"I thought of that. Maybe enter him in the President's Cup match next year," Clark mused. Then he turned.
"Go ahead, Yuri. Take him on. Maybe you will succeed where all of us failed."
"All of you, eh?"
"Every bloody one of us," Eddie Price confirmed. "I wonder why the Italian government gave him to us. If the Mafia want to go after him, I wish the bastards luck."
"This I must see," Kirillin persisted, leading his visitors to wonder how smart he was.
"Then you will see it, Tovarish General," Clark promised.
Karelin, who'd been on the Red Army pistol team as a lieutenant and a captain, couldn't conceive of being beaten in a pistol match. He figured these NATO people were just having fun with him, as he might do if the situation were reversed. He waved to the bartender and ordered pepper vodka for his own next round. But all that said, he liked these NATO visitors, and their reputation spoke forcefully for itself. This Chavez, a major, he was really CIA, Karelin knew, and evidently a good spy at that, according to his briefing from the SVR, had the look of a good soldier, with confidence won in the field, the way a soldier ought to win his confidence. Clark was much the same, and also very capable, so the book on him read, with his own ample experience both as a soldier and a spy. And his spoken Russian was superb and very literate, his accent of St. Petersburg, where he probably could, and probably once or twice had, Karelin reflected, pass for a native. It was so strange that such men as these had once been his sworn enemies. Had battle happened, it would have been bloody, and its outcome very sad. Karelin had spent 3 years in Afghanistan, and had learned firsthand just how horrid a thing combat was. He'd heard the stories from his father, a much-decorated infantry general. But hearing them wasn't the same as seeing, and besides, you never told the really awful parts because you tended to edit them out of your memory. One did not discuss seeing a friend's face turn to liquid from a rifle bullet over a few drinks in a bar, because it was just not the sort of thing you could describe to one who didn't understand. And you didn't need to describe it to one who did. You just lifted your glass to toast the memory of Grisha or Mirka or one of the others. And in the community of arms, that was enough. Did these men do it? Probably. They'd lost men once, when Irish terrorists had attacked their own home station, to their ultimate cost, but not without inflicting their own harm on highly trained men. And that was the essence of the profession of arms right there. You trained to skew the odds your way, but you could never quite turn them all the way in the direction you wished. Yu Chun had experienced a thoroughly vile day. In the city of Taipei, to look after her aged and seriously ill mother, she'd had a neighbor call urgently, telling her to switch on her TV, then seen her husband shot dead before her blinking eyes. And that had just been the first hammer blow of the day. The next one involved getting to Beijing. The first two flights to Hong Kong were fully booked, and that cost her 14 lonely and miserable hours sitting in the terminal as an anonymous face in a sea of such faces, alone with her horror and additional loneliness, until she finally boarded a flight to the PRC capital. That flight had been bumpy, and she had cowered in her last row window seat, hoping that no one could see the anguish on her face, but hiding it as well as she might conceal an earthquake. In due course, that trial had ended, and she managed to leave the aircraft, and actually made it through immigration and customs fairly easily because she carried virtually nothing that could conceal contraband. Then it started all over again with the taxi to her home. Her home was hidden behind a wall of policemen. She tried to pass through their line as one might wiggle through a market checkout, but the police had orders to admit no one into the house, and those orders did not include an exception for anyone who might actually live there. That took 20 minutes and three policemen of gradually increasing rank to determine. By this time she'd been awake for 26 hours and traveling for 22 of them. Tears did not avail her in the situation, and she staggered her way to the nearby home of a member of her husband's congregation, Wen Zhong, a man who operated a small restaurant right in his home, a tall and rotund man, ordinarily jolly, liked by all who met him. Seeing Chun, he embraced her and took her into his home, at once giving her a room in which to sleep and a few drinks to help her relax.
Yu-Chun was asleep in minutes, and would remain that way for some hours, while Wen figured he had his own things to do. About the only thing Chun had managed to say before collapsing from exhaustion was that she wanted to bring Fa An's body home for proper burial. That Wen couldn't do all by himself, but he called a number of his fellow parishioners to let them know that their pastor's widow was in town. He understood that the burial would be on the island of Taiwan, which was where Yu had been born, but his congregation could hardly bid their beloved spiritual leader farewell without a ceremony of its own. And so he called around to arrange a memorial service at their small place of worship. He had no way of knowing that one of the parishioners he called reported directly to the Ministry of State Security. Barry Wise was feeling pretty good about himself. While he didn't make as much money as his colleagues at the other so-called major networks, CNN didn't have an entertainment division to dump money into news. He figured that he was every bit as well known as their white talking heads. And he stood out from them by being a serious newsie who went into the field, found his own stories, and wrote his own copy. Barry Wise did the news, and that was all. He had a pass to the White House press room, and was considered in just about every capital city in the world, not only as a reporter with whom you didn't trifle, but also as an honest conveyor of information. He was by turns respected and hated, depending on the government and the culture. This government, he figured, had little reason to love him. To Barry Wise, they were fucking barbarians. The police here had delusions of godhood that evidently devolved from the big shots downtown, who must have thought their dicks were pretty big because they could make so many people dance to their tune. To Wise, that was the sign of a little one instead, but you didn't tell them that out loud because, small or not, they had cops with guns, and the guns were certainly big enough. But these people had huge weaknesses, Wise also knew. They saw the world in a distorted way, like people with astigmatism, and assumed that was its real shape. They were like scientists in a lab who couldn't see past their own theories and kept trying to twist the experimental data into the proper result, or ended up ignoring the data, which their theory couldn't explain. But that was going to change. Information was getting in. In allowing free market commerce, the government of the PRC had also allowed the installation of a forest of telephone lines. Many of them were connected to fax machines, and even more were connected to computers, and so lots of information was circulating around the country now. Wise wondered if the government appreciated the implications of that. Probably not. Neither Marx nor Mao had really understood how powerful a thing information was, because it was the place where one found the truth, once you rooted through it a little. And truth wasn't theory. Truth was the way things really were, and that's what made it a son of a bitch. You could deny it, but only at your peril, because sooner or later the son of a bitch would bite you on the ass. Denying it just made the inevitable bite worse, because the longer you put it off, the wider its jaws got. The world had changed quite a bit since CNN had started up. As late as 1980, a country could deny anything. But CNN signals, the voice and the pictures, came straight down from the satellite. You couldn't deny pictures worth a damn. And that made Barry Wise the croupier in the casino of information and truth. He was an honest dealer. He had to be in order to survive in the casino, because the customers demanded it. In the free marketplace of ideas, truth always won in the end, because it didn't need anything else to prop it up. Truth stood by itself, and sooner or later the wind would blow the props away from all the bullshit. It was a noble enough profession, Wise thought. His mission in life was reporting history, and along the way he got to make a little of it himself, or at least to help. And for that reason he was feared by those who thought that defining history was their exclusive domain. The thought often made him smile to himself. He'd helped a little the other day, Wise thought, with those two churchmen. He didn't know where it would lead. That was the work of others. He still had more work of his own to do in China. Chapter 29 Billy Budd.
So, what else is going to go wrong over there? Ryan asked.
Things will quiet down if the other side has half a brain, Adler said hopefully.
Do they? Robbie Jackson asked, just before Arnie Van Dam could.
Sir, that's not a question with an easy answer. Are they stupid?
No, they are not.
But do they see things in the same way that we do?
No, they do not.
That's the fundamental problem dealing with them.
Yeah, Klingons, Ryan observed tersely. Aliens from outer space.
Jesus, Scott, how do we predict what they're going to do?
We don't really, Sextate answered. We have a bunch of good people, but the problem is in getting them all to agree on something when we need an important call.
They never do, Adler concluded. He frowned before going on.
Look, these guys are kings from a different culture. It was already very different from ours long before Marxism arrived, and the thoughts of our old friend Carl only made things worse. They're kings because they have absolute power. There are some limitations on that power, but we don't fully understand what they are, and therefore it's hard for us to enforce or to exploit them.
They are Klingons.
So what we need is a Mr. Spock. Got one handy, anyone?
Around the coffee table there were the usual half-humorous snorts that accompany an observation that is neither especially funny nor readily escapable.
Nothing new from Sorga today? Van Dam asked.
Ryan shook his head.
No, the source doesn't produce something every day.
Pity, Adler said. I've discussed the take from Zorga with some of my I&R people, always as my own theoretical musings.
And? Jackson asked.
And they think it's decent speculation, but not something to bet the ranch on.
There was amusement around the coffee table at that one.
That's the problem with good intelligence information. It doesn't agree with what your own people think, assuming they really think at all, the vice president observed.
Not fair, Robbie, Ryan told his VP.
I know, I know.
Jackson held up surrendering hands.
I just can't forget the motto of the whole intelligence community. We bet your life. It's lonely out there with a fighter plane strapped to your back, risking your life on the basis of a piece of paper with somebody's opinion typed on it, when you never know the guy it's from or the data it's based on.
He paused to stir his coffee.
You know, out in the fleet we used to think, well, we used to hope, that decisions made in this room here were based on solid data. It's quite a disappointment to learn what things are really like.
Robbie, back when I was in high school, I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember wondering if the world was going to blow up. But I still had to translate half a page of Caesar's goddamned Gallic Wars, and I saw the president on TV, and I figured things were okay, because he was the president of the United Goddamn States, and he had to know what was really going on. So I translated the battle with the Helvetii and slept that night. The president knows because he's the president, right? Then I become president, and I don't know a damn thing more than I knew the month before, but everybody out there, Ryan waved his arm at the window, thinks I'm fucking omniscient.
Ellen, he called loudly enough to get through the door.
The door opened 7 seconds later.
Yes, Mr. President.
I think you know, Ellen, Jack told her.
Yes, sir.
She fished in her pocket and pulled out a flip-top box of Virginia Slims. Ryan took one out, along with the pink butane lighter stashed inside. He lit the smoke and took a long hit.
Thanks, Ellen.
Her smile was downright motherly.
Surely, Mr. President.
And she headed back to the secretary's room, closing the curved door behind her.
Jack?
Yeah, Rob, Ryan responded, turning.
That's disgusting.
Okay, I am not omniscient, and I'm not perfect, POTUS admitted crossly after the second puff. Now, back to China.
They can forget MFN, Van Dam said. Congress would impeach you if you asked for it, Jack. And you can figure that the Hill will offer Taiwan any weapons system they want to buy next go-round.
I have no problems with that. And there's no way I was going to offer them MFN anyway, unless they decide to break down and start acting like civilized people.
And that's the problem, Adler reminded them all. They think we're the uncivilized ones.
I see trouble, Jackson said, before anyone else could.
Ryan figured it was his background as a fighter pilot to be first in things.
They're just out of touch with the rest of the world. The only way to get them back in touch will involve some pain. Not to their people especially, but sure as hell to the guys who make the decisions.
And they're the ones who control the guns, Van Dam noted.
Roger that, Arnie, Jackson confirmed.
So how can we ease them the right way? Ryan asked, to center the conversation once more.
We stick to it. We tell them we want reciprocal trade access, or they will face reciprocal trade barriers. We tell them that this little flare-up with the Nuncio makes any concessions on our part impossible, and that's just how things are. If they want to trade with us, they have to back off, Adler spelled out.
They don't like being told such things, but it's the real world, and they have to acknowledge objective reality.
They do understand that, for the most part, Sextate concluded.
Ryan looked around the room and got nods.
Okay, make sure Rutledge understands what the message is, he told Eagle.
Yes, sir, Sextate agreed with a nod.
People stood and started filing out. Vice President Jackson allowed himself to be the last in the line of departure.
Hey, Rob, Ryan said to his old friend.
Funny thing. Watched some TV last night for a change. Caught an old movie I hadn't seen since I was a kid.
Which one?
Billy Budd, Melville's story about the poor dumb sailor who gets himself hanged. I'd forgot the name of Billy's ship.
Yeah?
So had Ryan.
It was The Rights of Man. Kind of a noble name for a ship.
I imagine Melville made that up with malice aforethought, like writers do, but that's what we fight for, isn't it? Even the Royal Navy, they just didn't fight as well as we did back then.
The Rights of Man, Jackson repeated.
It is a noble sentiment.
How does it apply to the current problem, Rob?
Jack, the first rule of war is the mission. First, why the hell are you out there, and then what are you proposing to do about it? The Rights of Man makes a pretty good starting point, doesn't it? By the way, CNN's going to be at Pabst Church tomorrow and at Jerry Patterson's. They're switching off, preaching in each other's pulpit for the memorial ceremonies, and CNN decided to cover it as a news event in and of itself. Good call, I think, Jackson editorialized. Wasn't like that in Mississippi back when I was a boy.
It's going to be like you said.
I'm only guessing, Robbie admitted, but I don't see either one of them playing it cool. It's too good an opportunity to teach a good lesson about how the Lord doesn't care a rat's ass what color we are, and how all men of faith should stand together. They'll both probably fold in the abortion thing. Pap ain't real keen on abortion rights, and neither's Patterson. But mainly it'll be about justice and equality and how two good men went to see God after doing the right thing.
Your dad's pretty good with a sermon, eh?
If they gave out Pulitzers for preaching, he'd have a wall covered in the things, Jack, and Jerry Patterson ain't too bad for a white boy either.
Ah, Yefremov observed.
He was in the building perch instead of one of the vehicles. It was more comfortable, and he was senior enough to deserve and appreciate the comforts. There was Suvorov slash Konyev sitting back on the bench, an afternoon newspaper in his hands. They didn't have to watch, but watch they did, just to be sure. Of course, there were thousands of park benches in Moscow, and the probability that their subject would sit in the same one this many times was genuinely astronomical. That's what they would argue to the judge when the time came for the trial, depending on what was in the subject's right hand. His KGB file said that he was right-handed, and it seemed to be the case. He was so skillful that you could hardly see what he did. But it was done, and it was seen. His right hand left the paper, reached inside his jacket, and pulled out something metallic. Then the hand paused briefly, and as he turned pages in the paper, the fluttering of the paper was a fine distraction to anyone who might be watching, since the human eye is always drawn to movement. The right hand slid down and affixed the metal transfer case to the magnetic holder. Then returned for the paper, all in one smooth motion, done so quickly as to be invisible. Well, almost, Yefremov thought. He'd caught spies before. Four of them, in fact, which explained his promotion to a supervisory position. And every one had a thrill attached to it, because he was chasing and catching the most elusive of game. And this one was Russian-trained, the most elusive of all. He'd never bagged one of them before, and there was the extra thrill of catching not just a spy, but a traitor as well. And perhaps a traitor guilty of murder, he wondered. That was another first. Never in his experience had espionage involved the violation of that law. No, an intelligence operation was about the transfer of information, which was dangerous enough. The inclusion of murder was an additional hazard that was not calculated to please a trained spy. It made noise, as they said, and noise was something a spy avoided as much as a cat burglar, and for much the same reason. "Call Provolov," Yefremov told his subordinate. Two reasons for that. First, he rather owed it to the militia lieutenant, who'd presented him with both the case and the subject. Second, the civilian cop might know something useful to his part of this case. They continued to watch Suvorov/Konyev for another 10 minutes. Finally, he stood and walked back to his car for the drive back to his apartment, during which he was duly followed by the ever-changing surveillance team. After the requisite 15 minutes, one of Yefremov's people crossed the street and retrieved the case from the bench. It was the locked one again, which told them that the item inside was perhaps more important. You had to get past the anti-tamper device to keep the contents from being destroyed. But the FSS had people well skilled in that, and the key for this transfer case had already been struck. That was confirmed 20 minutes later, when the case was opened and the contents extracted, unfolded, photographed, refolded, reinserted, and finally relocked in the container, which was immediately driven back to the bench. Back at FSS headquarters, the decryption team typed the message into a computer into which the one-time pad had already been inputted. After that, it was a matter of mere seconds before the computer performed a function not unlike sliding a document over a printed template. The clear-text message was agreeably in Russian. The content of the message was something else.
"Yob tvoyu mat," the technician breathed, in one of his language's more repulsive imprecations. "Fuck your mother."
Then he handed the page to one of the supervising inspectors, whose reaction was little different. Then he walked to the phone and dialed Yefremov's number.
"Pavel Georgievich, you need to see this."
Provolov was there when the chief of the decryption section walked in. The printout was in a manila folder, which the head crippy handed over without a word.
"Well, Pasha?" the homicide investigator asked. "Well, we have answered our first question."
"The motor car was even purchased at the same dealership in central Moscow," the sheet read. "There is no fault to be found here. The men who performed the mission are both dead in St. P. Before I can make another attempt, I need an indication from you on the timeline, and also on the payment to my contractors."
"Golovko was the target, then," Provolov observed.
"And the head of our country's intelligence service owes his life to a pimp."
"So it would appear," Yefremov agreed. "Note that he doesn't ask payment for himself. I would imagine he's somewhat embarrassed at having missed his target on the first attempt." But he's working for the Chinese. So that would appear as well, the FSS man observed, with an inward chill. Why, he asked himself, would the Chinese wish to do such a thing? Isn't that nearly an act of war? He sat back in his chair and lit up a smoke, looking into the eyes of his police colleague. Neither man knew what to say at the moment, and both kept silent. It would all soon be out of and far beyond their hands. With that decided, both men headed home for dinner. The morning broke more brightly than usual in Beijing. Mrs. Yu had slept deeply and well, and though she awoke with a slight headache, she was grateful for Wen's insistence on a couple of drinks before retiring. Then she remembered why she was in Beijing, and any good feelings departed from her mind. Breakfast was mainly green tea and was spent looking down, remembering the sound of her husband's voice in the bleak acceptance of the fact that she'd never hear it again. He'd always been in a good mood over breakfast, never forgetting, as she had just done, to say grace over the morning meal and thank God for another day in which to serve him. No more. No more would he do that, she reminded herself. But she had duties of her own to perform. "What can we do, Zhang?" she asked, when her host appeared. "I will go with you to the police post, and we will ask for Fa An's body. And then I will help you fly our friend home. And we will have a memorial prayer service at the—" "No, you can't, Zhang. There are police there to keep everyone out. They wouldn't even let me in, even though I had my papers in order." "Then we will have it outside, and they will watch us pray for our friend," the restaurateur told his guest with gentle resolve. 10 minutes later she'd cleaned up and was ready to leave. The police station was only 4 blocks away, a simple building, ordinary in all respects except for the sign over the door. "Yes," the desk officer said when his peripheral vision noted the presence of people by his desk. He looked up from the paper forms that had occupied his attention for the past few minutes to see a woman and a man of about the same age. "I am Yu Chun," Mrs. Yu answered, seeing some recognition in the desk officer's eyes result from her words. "You are the wife of Yu Fa An?" he asked. "That is correct." "Your husband was an enemy of the people," the cop said next. Sure of that, but not sure of much else in this awkward case. "I believe he was not. But all I ask is for his body, so that I might fly it home for burial with his family." "I do not know where his body is," the cop said. "But he was shot by a policeman," Wen put in, "and the disposal of his body is therefore a police matter. So might you be so kind, comrade, as to call the proper number so that we can remove our friend's body?" His manners did not allow anger on the part of the desk officer. But the desk cop really didn't know what number to call, and so he called someone inside the building, in the large administration division. He found this embarrassing to do with 2 citizens standing by his desk, but there was no avoiding that. "Yes," a voice answered on his 3rd internal call. "This is Sergeant Zhang at the desk in the public lobby. I have Yu Chun here, seeking the body of her husband, Yu Fa An. I need to tell her where to go." The reply took a few seconds for the man on the other end of the phone, who had to remember. "Ah, yes. Tell her she can go to the Da Yunhe River. His body was cremated and the ashes dumped in the water last evening. And, enemy of the people or not, it would not be a pleasant thing to tell his widow, who'd probably had feelings for him." Sergeant Zhang set the phone down and decided to give her the news. "The body of Yu Fa An was cremated and the ashes scattered in the river, comrade." "That is cruel," Wen said at once. Chun was too stunned to say anything at the moment. "I cannot help you more than that,"
Zhang told his visitors, and looked back down at his paperwork to dismiss them. "Where is my husband?" Yu Chun managed to blurt, after 30 seconds or so of silence. "Your husband's body was cremated and the ashes scattered," Zhang said, without looking up, because he really didn't wish to see her eyes under these circumstances. "I cannot help you further. You may leave now." "I want my husband back," she insisted. "Your husband is dead and his body has been cremated." "Begone now," Sergeant Zhang insisted in return, wishing she'd just go away and allow him to get back to his paperwork. "I want my husband," she said louder now, causing a few eyes to turn her way in the lobby. "He is gone, Chun," Wen Zhang told her, taking her arm and steering her to the door. "Come, we will pray for him outside."
"But why did they? I mean, why is he? And why did they?"
It had just been too much for 1 24-hour period. Despite the night's sleep, Yu Chun was still too disoriented. Her husband of over 20 years had vanished, and now she could not even see the urn containing his ashes. It was a lot to absorb for a woman who'd never so much as bumped into a policeman on the street, who'd never done a single thing to offend the state, except, perhaps, to marry a Christian. But what did that hurt, anyway? Had either of them, had any of their congregation, ever plotted treason against the state? No. Had any of them so much as violated the criminal or civil law? No. And so why had this misfortune fallen upon her? She felt as though she'd been struck by an invisible truck while crossing the street. Then had it decided that her injuries were all her fault. Behind one invisible truck was just another, and all the more merciless at that. There was nothing left for her to do, no recourse, legal or otherwise. They couldn't even go into her home, whose living room had so often served as their church, there to pray for Yu's soul and entreat God for mercy and help. Instead, they'd pray. Where? She wondered. One thing at a time. She and Wen walked outside, escaping the eyes of the lobby, which had zoomed in on them with almost physical impact. The eyes and the weight they'd carried were soon left behind. But the sun outside was just one more thing that intruded on what ought to have been, and what needed to be, a day of peace and lonely prayer to a God whose mercy was not very evident at the moment. Instead, the brightness of the sun defeated her eyelids, bringing unwanted brilliance into the darkness that might have simulated, if not exactly granted, peace. She had a flight booked back to Hong Kong, and from there back to Taipei, where she could at least weep in the presence of her mother, who was awaiting her death as well, for the woman was over 90 and frail. For Barry Wise, the day had long since begun. His colleagues in Atlanta had praised him to the heavens in an email about his earlier story. "Maybe another Emmy," they said. Wise liked getting the awards, but they weren't the reason for his work. It was just what he did. He wouldn't even say he enjoyed it, because the news he reported was rarely pretty or pleasant. It was just his job, the work he'd chosen to do. If there was an aspect of it that he actually liked, it was the newness of it. Just as people awoke wondering what they'd see on CNN every day, from baseball scores to executions, so he awoke every day wondering what he'd report. He often had some idea of where the story would be and roughly what it would contain, but you were never really sure, and in the newness was the adventure of his job. He'd learned to trust his instincts, though he never really understood where they came from or how they seemed to know what they did. And today his instincts reminded him that one of the people he'd seen shot the other day had said he was married, and that his wife was on Taiwan. Maybe she'd be back now. It was worth trying out. He tried to get Atlanta to check with the Vatican, but that story would be handled by the Rome Bureau. The aircraft containing Cardinal DeMillo's body was on its way back to Italy, where somebody would be making a big deal about it for CNN to cover live and on tape to show to the entire world 10 times at least. The hotel room had a coffee maker, and he brewed his own from beans stolen from the CNN Beijing bureau office. Sipping coffee for him, as for so many others, helped him think. Okay, he thought. The Italian guy, the cardinal, his body was gone, boxed and shipped out on an Alitalia 747, probably somewhere over Afghanistan right now. But what about the Chinese guy, the Baptist minister who took the round in the head? He had to have left a body behind, too. And he had a congregation, and he said he was married, didn't he? Okay, if so, he had a wife somewhere, and she'd want the body back to bury. So, at the least, he could try to interview her. It would be a good follow-up, and would allow Atlanta to play the tape of the killings again. He was sure the Beijing government had written him onto their official shit list, but fuck 'em, Wise thought with a sip of the Starbucks. It was hardly a disgrace to be there, was it? These people were racist as hell. Even folks on the street cringed to see him pass, with his dark skin. Even Birmingham under Bull Connor hadn't treated black Americans like aliens from another goddamn planet. Here everyone looked the same, dressed the same, talked the same. Hell, they needed some black people just to liven up the mix some. Toss in a few blonde Swedes and maybe a few Italians to set up a decent restaurant. But it wasn't his job to civilize the world, just to tell people what was going on in it. The trade folks were not where it was happening, not today, Wise thought. Today he and his satellite truck would head back to the home of Reverend Yufa An. Wise was playing a hunch. No more than that. But they'd rarely failed him before. Ryan was enjoying another night off. The following night would be different. He had to give another goddamn speech on foreign policy. Why he couldn't simply announce policy in the press room and be done with it, nobody had yet told him. And he hadn't asked, for fear of looking the fool again before Arnie. This was just how it was done. The speech and the subject had nothing to do with the identity of the group he was addressing. Surely there had to be an easier way to tell the world what he thought. This way, too, Kathy had to come with him. And she hated these things even more than he did, because it took her away from her patient notes, which she guarded about as forcefully as a lion over the wildebeests he'd just killed for lunch. Kathy often complained that this first lady stuff was hurting her performance as a surgeon. Jack didn't believe that. It was more likely that, like most women, Kathy needed something to bitch about. And this subject was worthier than her more pedestrian complaints, like being unable to cook dinner once in a while, which she missed a lot more than the women's lib people would have cared to learn. Kathy had spent over 20 years learning to be a gourmet cook, and when time allowed, rarely, she'd sneak down to the capacious White House kitchen to trade ideas and recipes with the head chef. For the moment, however, she was curled up in a comfortable chair making notes on her patient files and sipping at her wine glass, while Jack watched TV. For a change not under the eyes of the Secret Service detail and the domestic staff. But the President wasn't really watching TV. His eyes were pointed in that direction, but his mind was looking at something else. It was a look his wife had learned to understand in the past year. Almost like open-eyed sleep while his brain churned over a problem. In fact, it was something she did herself often enough, thinking about the best way to treat a patient's problem while eating lunch at the Hopkins doctor's cafeteria, her brain creating a picture as though in a Disney cartoon, simulating the problem and then trying out theoretical fixes. It didn't happen all that much anymore. The laser applications she'd helped to develop were approaching the point that an auto mechanic could perform them, which was not something she or her colleagues advertised, of course. There had to be a mystique with medicine, or else you lost your power to tell your patients what to do in a way that ensured that they might actually do it. For some reason, that didn't translate to the presidency, Kathy thought. With Congress, well, most of the time they went along with him. As well they ought,
since Jack's requests were usually as reasonable as they could be. But not always, and often for the dumbest reasons. "It may be good for the country, but it's not so good for my district, and they all forgot the fact that when they had arrived in Washington, they'd sworn an oath to the country, not to their stupid little districts. When she'd said that to Arnie, he'd had a good laugh and lectured her on how the real world worked. As though a physician didn't know that, she fumed. And so Jack had to balance what was real with what wasn't, but ought to be, as opposed to what wasn't and never would be. Like foreign affairs. It made a lot more sense for a married man to have an affair with some floozy than it did to try to reason with some foreign countries. At least you could tell the floozy that it was all over after three or four times. But these damned foreign chiefs of state would stay around forever with their stupidity. That was one nice thing about medicine, Professor Ryan thought. Doctors all over the world treated patients pretty much the same way because the human body was the same everywhere. And a treatment regimen that worked at Johns Hopkins in East Baltimore worked just as well in Berlin or Moscow or Tokyo, even if the people looked and talked different. And if that was true, why couldn't people all over the world think the same way? Their damned brains were the same, weren't they? Now it was her turn to grumble, as her husband did often enough. "Jack," she said, as she put her notebook down. "Yeah, Kathy? What are you thinking about now?" "Mainly how I wish Ellen Sumter was here with a cigarette," he couldn't say. If Kathy knew he was sneaking smokes in the Oval Office, she didn't let on, which was probably the case, since she didn't go around looking for things to fight over, and he never ever smoked in front of her or the kids anymore. Kathy allowed him to indulge his weaknesses as long as he did so in the utmost moderation. But her question was about the cause for his yearning for some nicotine. "China, babe. They really stepped on the old crank with the golf shoes this time, but they don't seem to know how bad it looked." "Killing those two people? How could it not look bad?" Surgeon asked. "Not everybody values human life in the same way that we do, Kath. The Chinese doctors I've met are... well, they're doctors, and we talk to each other like doctors." "I suppose." Ryan saw a commercial start on the TV show he was pretending to watch, and stood to walk off to the upstairs kitchen for another whiskey. "Refill, babe?"
"Yes, thank you,"
with her Christmas tree smile. Jack lifted his wife's wine glass. So she had no procedures scheduled for the next day. She'd come to love the Chateau Saint-Michel Chardonnay they'd first sampled at Camp David. For him tonight it was wild turkey bourbon over ice. He loved the pungent smell of the corn and rye grains, and tonight he dismissed the upstairs staff and could enjoy the relative luxury of fixing his own. He could even have made a peanut butter sandwich, had he been of such a mind. He walked the drinks back, touching his wife's neck on the way, and getting the cute little shiver she always made when he did so.
"So what's going to happen in China?"
"We'll find out the same way as everybody else, watching CNN. They're a lot faster than our intelligence people on some things, and our spooks can't predict the future any better than the traders on Wall Street." "You'd be able to identify such a man at Merrill Lynch easily if he existed," Jack didn't bother saying aloud. "He'd be the guy with all the millionaires lined up outside his office."
"So, what do you think?"
"I'm worried, Kath," Ryan admitted, sitting back down.
"About what?"
"About what we'll have to do if they screw things up again. But we can't warn them. That only makes it certain that bad things are going to happen, because then they'll do something really dumb just to show us how powerful they are. That's how nation-states are. You can't talk to them like real people. The people who make the decisions over there think with their dicks.